the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. We're going to be covering some issues that normally take place about this time of the year, but also something that impacts so many of you who are getting ready to retire.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest this week is Dr. Gary Small from the UCLA Longevity Center. We'll be talking about preventing dementia and Alzheimer's and other related issues as a part of advancing in your years.
You know, it's amazing when we get to this interview because, John, we've all heard about very famous people. One thinks of President Reagan with Alzheimer's. 75% of dementia and Alzheimer is a lifestyle choice. I always thought this was something that was hereditary. So you're definitely going to want to listen to this interview coming up. He's written several books, too, by the way. We'll talk about that in the interview. In the meantime, let's get on with today's subject. It's amazing, John. The year has passed so quickly. And we are going to be covering a number of issues in the weeks ahead, especially as we get in towards the end of the year. We're going to talk about taxes. We're going to do a show on charitable gifting because it's the time of the year that you think about it. And it's also the time of the year you want to make sure you get that tax deduction. We're going to talk about year-end tax maneuvers. We did that the previous week. But today we're going to talk about retirement plan distributions. Like everything else, there's a tax code, there's numerous rules, there's all kinds of regulations, including new IRS rules on IRA rollovers that go into effect in 2015.
Seems like everybody needs a tax expert, which is really a good argument for why we need to just simply repeal the income tax code and go with a national sales tax or something like that, something much simpler. But for now, and probably for some time to come, it's going to be with us, because if we were to do something like that, politicians, well, they wouldn't have anything to play leverage with favorites over. Tax code, however, is very, very complex. No one really seems to understand it. If you're going to do anything more than just a basic return, it seems like you need a CPA, or you have to be one, or a tax attorney. AMT tax is something that nobody really comprehends. Why, after you've paid your tax, suddenly another tax kicks in and everyone forgets that the AMT was put there to capture money from people who had large amounts of income, but who had managed to structure legally their income in such a way as to avoid legitimately paying the tax. And so as a result of this, very much like all of the laws in the country, they're so complex that many people are caught unawares. And the other problem is, not only are they complex, they're changing on a regular basis. So unfortunately, what they wind up doing is not complying out of ignorance, which means they usually get hit with some kind of penalty. So we're going to examine this issue today, the idea of planning for retirement, but also dealing with the labyrinth that is tax preparation.
Yeah, let's begin with an important deadline. The government doesn't want you to keep your retirement assets forever, and they want the opportunity to tax them. This mainly applies to things like IRAs, SEPs, simple IRAs, tax sheltered annuities, TSAs. The rule doesn't apply to Roth IRAs, which if you keep them 5 years, they're tax-free. And the date that we're talking about is April 1st in the year that you attain the age of 70 and a half. And what happens is at that point, you are required to take a mandatory distribution from your IRA. And folks, this is something you want to pay a lot of attention to. You want to make sure, especially if you have multiple IRA accounts, that you add them all up and take them all into consideration, because the penalties are hefty. And we'll get into how hefty those penalties are in just a moment.
All right. Well, if we look at penalties, you know, sometimes you think about $100 here, $100 there. How big can these penalties get? And what does that mean in terms of actually coming in and plundering some of your retirement account?
Well, the penalty, John, is actually hefty. It's probably one of the biggest ones that the government has. It's 50% of the required distribution. Now, let's make an example of this to illustrate. Let's say that the required distribution is $20,000 a year. You've got IRAs spread all over the place. You only take out $10,000 instead of $20,000. So the penalty would be 50% of the $10,000 you should have taken out, in this case, $5,000. That's quite hefty. We see this really becoming an issue when people have a lot of multiple IRAs. And sometimes you just forget about them. Oh, gosh, when you have seven or eight of them, I've got one with the mutual fund. I have one with an insurance company. I have two or three brokerage accounts. It's another reason the closer you get to age 70 and a half, you really want to consolidate it so that your custodian, your advisor, it's done automatically for you. You don't have to think about it. And you don't want to get surprised meeting with your accountant and says, oh, by the way, you should have taken this distribution. You owe a penalty. And we should talk about some other things that are going into effect in 2015, which are rollover options that are some new rules that just came down from the IRS here in the last couple of weeks. There's been new rule change. Surprise, surprise, folks. You know, they're always tinkering with these laws and they just did it again. But in this case, it's a little bit more favorable.
Well, I'm never surprised with the changes, although every once in a while you have to wonder whether or not you even want to deal with it because they're always changing the laws. So it's very difficult to plan when somebody's changing the ground rules in it. But anyway, what did the IRS do this time?
Well, this time, this has to do with rollovers. And the rules are, most people, when they do a rollover, let's say they're working at a company, it's usually a trustee-to-trustee transfer. The trustee that manages your 401k is transferring your assets to your trustee that's going to manage your IRA. So most people do what we call trustee-to-trustee transfers. Let's say you had $100,000 in a, I don't know, let's say a CD at a bank that was an IRA. It comes due. You take the distribution, you don't roll it over because you're thinking, you know, I'm not sure what I want to do. Do I want to put it in a mutual fund? Do I want to buy stocks? You can take actual cash distributions as long as within 60 days you roll it over. Now, there's a 60-day rule, and you're allowed to do this once for every 12-month period. And there's also special rules, like let's say you have three IRAs. If you take a cash distribution or a distribution in kind, maybe stocks or something, before you roll it over for 60 days, you can only do that once. It doesn't matter if you have six IRAs. If you did it with one of your IRAs, that's it. That's the rule. Now, what they're doing, beginning in 2015, they're saying, hey, if you already did it in a 12-month period in 2014, we're not going to count it. There's a fresh slate that begins January 1st of 2015. So let's say you took a cash distribution and I don't know, let's say in July of this year, normally under the old rules, you'd have to wait another 12 months before you could do that again. Sometimes people do this. They're short of cash. They borrow for 60 days. I've seen this done a number of times. However, what they're saying here, nope, we're going to wipe the slate clean beginning January 1st. Even if you took one 2 months ago, you could take one in December. You could do it again in January. Now, most of us in the field advise that people don't do this. It's much safer to do a trustee-to-trustee transfer because it's very easy, folks, to forget about that 60-day period that you have to get it over to a trustee, and you really don't want to get all of what you've taken out taxed in 1 year because you forgot, because that's what will happen if you go past the 60-day period. So we really don't advise doing it. But it is one law that's actually kind of favorable in this sense that goes into effect January of 2015.
Well, maybe we should move on to pension rollovers. For most boomers, that's going to be the most likely choice. The days of defined benefit plan accounts are pretty much all but gone unless you work for the government. Most baby boomers either have 401k, Social Security, or personal savings to rely on income in retirement.
Well, basically, upon retirement, you have several options, John, and well, actually, you probably almost have three. You can take the money and pay the taxes, and there's a whole slew of rules on forward averaging, depending on when you were born. Or you can defer the taxes through a rollover. You just basically take your pension, you roll it over to an IRA, and you can even defer taking that income depending on your age. And the third is some companies offer what is called annuity options. And that is they're going to basically give your principal with some rate of return in a monthly payment that's going to last your lifetime or that of both you and your spouse. So you really have three options. And you can do a number of things. You can roll over IRAs to other IRAs. You can roll over from an IRA to a SEP. You can roll over to a Roth, but bear in mind, you're going to pay the taxes up front. There's all kinds of rules from things like qualified plans, simple IRAs, Roth IRAs, 403b plans, which are primarily used in education. You can roll those over into an IRA. You can also, if you're working for the government, their version of the 401k program is called the 457 plan. And you can roll those over into an IRA from an IRA. But what you can't do is mix. Let's say you worked for a corporation in the public sector and then you go work in the education sector. You cannot roll over a 401k to a 403b plan. So there are some restrictions. And, you know, quite honestly, I've got a little cheat sheet that is made. It's sort of a tax planning fact sheet. And we could probably spend the next hour in different details. But if I was to simplify it, I would say most individually, the individual option to the IRA rollover is probably the most practical one, because for many individuals, it's going to be a sizable amount. And unless you have all kinds of other personal assets, or maybe the amount isn't large enough and maybe you want to do a Roth conversion compound tax-free, because right now, if you were to take the distribution in cash, it really doesn't work out that well, because a lot of you have very sizable amounts in your 401k plans. And, you know, what you don't want to do is, especially if it's over $450,000 or $400,000 if you're single, put yourself in the Obamacare tax rates, which can go as high as 44% on the federal level. Not to mention in a high tax state like California, you can add 13.3. Imagine giving 57% of your IRA to the government up front. And we'll talk about at death, that is something that can happen when the last spouse passes away if you don't structure your IRA beneficiaries appropriately and it's sizable. The government can take 57% of your IRA at death. So the rollover allows you a lot greater flexibility. And it also allows for tax inversions, which are becoming more and more popular with the retirees today as they look at the cost of living. They take a look at taxes. They look at the low interest rate environment. There are a lot of things they can't control in their life that they can through a tax inversion. It's some of the trends that we're seeing now. One, people are working longer. In other words, they're not retiring at age 62. A lot of them are postponing retirement to age 66, where they get full retirement benefits. A lot more people are working part-time, and a lot more individuals are going through tax inversions to make retirement work out.
Let's talk about tax inversions so that people understand it is legal tax avoidance, not illegal tax evasion.
Yeah, want to make that one very clear. Tax inversion is what you're seeing happen at the corporate level, where a corporation will buy an interest in another company that is domiciled in another country that has a lower tax rate, because the United States has the highest corporate tax rates. Well, individuals have been doing this for a long period of time. And what you're doing in a tax inversion is you're saying, hey, I worked in California, a very high tax state, very high cost of living. I'm going to move to some other place that is a lot cheaper. And we know there are a lot of high tax states like California, Hawaii, New York, several states where, you know, the tax rates are high single digits, or in the case of Hawaii, California, double digits. And so let's say you retire, you're living in California, you roll over your 401k program into an IRA. Now that it's in the IRA, you're saying, you know what, I don't want to stay here. It's too expensive. There's too many taxes. I'm going to go to Nevada where there's no income taxes. So immediately, I mean, everybody in California is in a 9.3% tax rate. You make 50, 60 grand, you hit that 9.3% rate. By simply moving to Nevada, there's like 8 states that have no income taxes. You automatically eliminate the state income tax. That's something that you have under control. So you can move from a high tax state like California to a no tax state and begin your distributions when you're living in a state that doesn't tax you. So that way, the IRA rollover allows you some flexibility. You can cut a major expense in retirement, which is your income taxes. And it's why, John, we're seeing a lot of these tax-free states with growing populations like Florida, Texas, or even low-tax states like Arizona. And with proper planning, you can keep yourself in that 15 to 25%, maybe 28% tax rate versus the 40% combined tax rates, or even higher if you live in the state of California, where you can take it all the way up to 57% with the combination of federal and state taxes. So simply, all a tax inversion is you're moving from a high tax state to a low tax state or a no tax state.
What are the other decisions that we need to make regarding rollover distributions outside of avoiding tax? There are investment choices, beneficiaries, all of those things that are associated with it.
Beneficiaries is another thing that's a quite complex issue. typically for most individuals, unless the spouse is a waiver, and sometimes this is going to happen in a second marriage, is the beneficiary on your IRA is typically going to be, if you're married, your surviving spouse, or if you're not married, maybe a relative, a brother, sibling, etc. And there's all kinds of rules regarding this in terms of you die before you retire, after you retire, you get age 70 and a half, there's minimum distributions, there's death of a surviving spouse, where you want to avoid, especially if you have children, a lump sum distribution including in the final income tax return in the year of death. Because think about it. Let's say you had $1 million IRA, $750,000. You could be subject to the high Obamacare tax rates of up to 44%, not to mention what you're going to pay in state income taxes. Imagine that getting clipped off the top. So you want to avoid these lump sum taxes in the year of death of the final survivor. And there's a lot of rules that apply to this. And it should be done with some thoughtful planning with either your CPA, tax advisor, or your financial advisor. Because really what you're trying to do is avoid a lump sum taxation of death. I mean, think of the amount of the assets that you have in your IRA. Do you really want to give 50, 60% of it at your death, the final spouse, or to the government? Wouldn't it be better to plan that out and stretch the payments and the taxability at much lower tax rates? So beneficiary provisions of IRAs, John, that's a whole topic in itself. Maybe that's a topic we'll cover in the near future here on the program.
Okay, well, if we put that off to some future date, any other tax traps where you should probably be considering? I mean, my understanding is that IRA distributions are taxed as ordinary income.
That's absolutely correct. Doesn't matter what you do inside your IRA, whether it's capital gains, whether it's dividends or it's interest, it's all taxed as ordinary income. And you have to be careful with planning this because at age 70 and a half, you're going to have to begin mandatory distributions. And those distributions increase with age, so they're going to get larger and larger. So you could find yourself in a increasing tax bracket. In other words, as those distributions increase, they're mandatory. There's nothing you can do about it. It's not going to be taxed as capital gains. It's going to be taxed as ordinary income. And it's going to put you, if you're not careful of how you plan, into a permanent higher tax bracket. And more importantly, as those distributions increase in a low interest rate environment, you're going to be eating through your principal. In other words, the distributions are going to be higher than the amount that you're actually earning in your investment account.
Let's go back to this point that you made right there, Jim, where distributions are larger than the returns from your account.
Well, this is happening, John. We're seeing this happen more and more today, especially in this low interest rate environment where you have, you know, 1 year treasury bills at 0.1%, and you've got the 10-year treasury note at 2.3. So it's very difficult for returns to exceed distribution requirements. It's another reason why we like laddered bonds. Well, maybe not so much now because rates are so low, but it's one of the reasons we were using laddered bonds because income distributions were coming down in bond funds. And it's also another reason why dividend stocks have become so important, because not only are the returns on stocks higher than what you can get in the bond market, first time in my entire career that I've seen that, and first time probably you'd have to go back to the 50s when these conditions existed where stocks actually had a higher yield than what you could get in the bond market. But not only can you get a higher return, but more importantly, those dividends are going up at 8 to 10% a year. So each year that you get older, the government's going to require a higher distribution rate from your IRA. Wouldn't it be nice if you had something in your IRA that was increasing at 8 to 10% a year so you could avoid dipping into principal, because those distribution requirements, folks, are going to go up every single year. Every year you get older, you're going to be taking out a larger amount out of that IRA. The government's going to get its pound of flesh one way or another.
So how do you combat rising distributions, especially if you look at the low interest rate world we live in right now?
It can be difficult. You know, fixed income today, you know, the interest rates in the bond market are just not that attractive. We would have to go into high quality corporate bonds because you don't want to take any risk. Even worse, John, some people have illiquid assets such as real estate, or what they did is they annuitized their annuity earlier. And now the distributions are much higher than the annuity rate. And the only way to combat that is through growth. Let's say you have the assets grow, or in a growth in assets or in income. And sometimes it's going to be a combination of both. But it used to be we had various options that we could sort of minimize the distributions. We could base it on the joint life expectancy of a husband and wife. Obviously, a woman's life expectancy is greater, and especially if she's younger in age, we could do it with a sibling. We used to have all these flexibility, but you know, the government, and especially when we began to run into trillion-dollar deficits, the IRS changed the rules. Now the distribution rates are set by the IRS, and they're much, much higher. So they want to tax it. And so that's what they've done. It's another source of income. It's why they lifted the rules on Roth conversions, because they know that when somebody converts a regular IRA to a Roth, all the taxes are up front. Folks, it's just the government's way of looking for more ways to get revenue. But unfortunately, in today's low interest rate environment, unless you've done some planning and have some growth in income or growth in assets, you're going to end up going through principal.
Well, as you said, most retirees take the rollover option, but let's just think about it. Are there times that that maybe wouldn't be advisable? I mean, for example, take annuity payment.
There is. And this is a viable option for many individuals where the annuity option makes sense. And it really depends on several factors. The most important one is the need for income to cover basic expenses. You may not be able to roll over your assets into an IRA and earn enough of a return to cover your basic living expenses, in which case, you know, you really have to look at what is the alternative returns that you can earn if you roll it over into an IRA versus the annuity option that you're going to get from the company. Because annuity, in one sense, is a return of capital. One of the reasons the distribution rates are higher is you're getting your principal back in addition to a rate of return. So depending on what your annuity option is based on, let's say your life and that of your spouse, which is what most people would do if they're married, when the last spouse passes away, there is no distributions left to the children unless there was like a 10-year certain and both spouses died within a 10-year rate. So in many instances, the annuitization option can make the difference of allowing an individual to retire when they don't have sufficient assets or sufficient returns to basically live and cover their basic living expenses. Now, under those circumstances, John, it's always better in most cases to take the annuity option.
Once they roll over, do you recommend taking income, or are they better to just allow the assets to accumulate?
A lot depends, and this is something that most individuals do not really look at when they're putting together a retirement plan. A lot of this depends on your life expectancy. Now, everyone talks about your number. In other words, what is the number you need to get in terms of assets to retire? Folks, I hate to tell you, there's more than one number. The most important number is really not the amount of assets that you have. It's really your life expectancy. When they put Social Security into effect in the 30s, John, the average male was expected to live to age 65. Now it's 75 and close to 80. So at age 65, a male's life expectancy is 19 years. A woman's is 22. So the average life expectancy of a couple age 65 would be 20 years. That has increased almost 4 years over the last couple of decades. And what we're starting to see, and I think this is going to become a prominent issue, is an impending retirement crisis. More Americans are facing the increasingly likelihood of outliving their resources. And the dangerous fact, they may be totally unaware of it. Of age 65 individuals, 25% of the age 65 age class has a chance of making it into their 90s. So they have a problem. They may not realize it. So it's not just the number. Hey, what is it? What's the number I need to get to retirement? It's not just how much you need. The second number that you're going to need is how long are you going to live? What's your life expectancy given your age? And also hereditary wise, how long do people live in your family? You may come from a family where they live into their 90s. And there's another number. How much are you going to end up spending during your lifetime on medical expenses? A couple age 65 will end up spending $230,000 on medical expenses during their lifetime. That's a number that's never discussed. And how many will have a situation where one spouse, and sometimes ultimately two, will end up in a long-term care facility? The real risk is when the first one ends up in a long-term care facility, because then you're maintaining two households. So sadly, John, most Americans don't have a plan.
Well, it is that time of the program when we take everything that has been under discussion here and put it into perspective with a case study, that of Jim and Barbara Walker. The names are fictitious, but the case study is real.
We're going to call this Jim and Barbara Walker. Jim was age 62. His full retirement age would be age 66, at which time he would receive $28,000 in Social Security. His wife, Barbara, was 56 years old. She was a teacher in high school, making close to $90,000 a year. With 30 years of service, she had to work two more years, and she would have 30 years of service. Her $90,000 salary would convert to a pension that was over $59,000 a year. You often hear us talk about three phases in retirement. We're going to talk about it here in this case. Expenses were roughly about $85,000 a year. Bucket list, which would include travel, was estimated to be about $15,000 a year. So roughly about $100,000 in retirement. Now, I know a lot of you that live in Nebraska, Iowa, are probably thinking, wow, that's a lot of money. Folks, in California, $100,000 of income does not buy you a lot here because it's very high cost of living state. Housing is expensive, food's expensive, gasoline's expensive, utilities expensive, taxes, I don't care, sales tax, property tax, gas tax, everything you can think of is expensive here. Now, looking at their assets, they had a home worth about $1.1 million with a mortgage roughly about just slightly under $300,000, $298,000, fixed mortgage at 3.5%. They wanted to stay in the house. They liked the neighborhood. They were close to all their friends. And with their kids scattered all over the country, they wanted to have a place. The kids can always come back with their grandchildren and have a place to stay. So they were keeping the home. And quite honestly, they could afford to keep it. Jim's 401k program was roughly about $800,000. Barbara's 403b plan was roughly about $300,000. They had almost $200,000 in personal investments, including almost half of that in the stock of the company that Jim worked for. Cash in the bank, about $75,000. And Jim had two pension plans at work. He had a defined benefit plan, roughly with about $450,000 of equivalent assets in it, in addition to his 401k program. Total assets, roughly about $2.9 million. The investments roughly were about 64% of their net worth, so that looked pretty good. So the first phase was we had two periods of time that were critical. A four-year time span from 62 to age 66 until Jim would get his full Social Security benefits of $28,000. And we had a two-year time span from age 56 to 58 for Barbara when she would have 30 years with the school system. She would get her pension of roughly over $59,000 a year. So the first thing that made sense was to roll over the 401k program roughly of $800,000 to an IRA. It just made a lot of sense. The second thing, however, is we needed a steady form of income. And remember, the more that you have in predictable guaranteed income to cover your basic living expenses, the greater security you're going to have in retirement. And we looked at the defined benefit pension options. He had two, actually had six. He could take the annuity payment based on his life only. The fact that he was 6 years older than Barbara, that didn't make a lot of sense. So there was 100% distribution we were looking at on his joint life, meaning that the pension would not change if something happened to Jim. And then there was the 75% option. The 100% option was $2,150 a month. That would continue throughout Jim's lifetime and also Barbara's lifetime. The 75% option was roughly $2,495. It just didn't make a lot of sense to reduce it by 25%. So we elected and recommended the 100% annuity option to both Jim and Barbara. That would produce an income of $25,800. When Barbara retired in two more years, her $90,000 salary would convert to a pension of $59,400. And then at age 66, Jim's Social Security of $28,000. That would be $113,000 a year. So easily covering their not only fixed expenses, but also their bucket list with money left over.
Now that we've sort of laid this background, why don't we talk about the different phases of retirement in more detail, because you stage what you do at various points.
Well, the real critical point was a shortfall within phase one, the first 2 years with Barbara continuing to work. But she planned to work to 58, where she'd have 30 years of service. So the income that we looked at in phase one, we had the defined benefit annuity option that was $25,800 and a combination of fixed income in stocks on the IRA. That was roughly about $28,000 plus personal investments of $200,000. So roughly almost $61,000 of income. And the other thing that we had going in phase one is we had Barbara's salary of $90,000. So there was no problem whatsoever. They didn't need to take the income from the IRA. So the only thing that they were going to do is take the income from the personal investments, because with Barbara's salary of $90,000, Jim's pension at $25,800, plus the $7,000 of personal investments, they had more than enough to cover their income. Now, phase two was Barbara retires. So Barbara retires, her pension was going to be $59,000, Jim's annuity, $25,800. That's $84,000 of almost $85,000. In phase two, we would begin to take distributions from his IRA. That would be roughly $28,000. And then also we would roll over Barbara's $300,000 of her 403B. It'd probably be a little larger into an IRA. And that would produce about $10,000 worth of income. That would be a total income of roughly close to $150,000. And then you add Social Security. You know, when you take a look at expenses of $100,000 and $50,000, in this case, really what we were looking at is what we were going to do with the income. Where was the income going to go? We might probably be moving more towards a tax-free bond portfolio on the personal side, because eventually, when they both got to age 70, imagine what the $800,000 IRA and Barbara's $300,000, you know, you're talking about almost $1.1 million in retirement assets. That could be $1.5, $1.8 million worth of distributions. So what we decided that we were going to do is, as this excess income they didn't use, we would start building a tax-free bond portfolio so that they would not have to compete as these distributions increased as the IRAs grew over time. It also created an estate planning problem. And what we did is, they already had a living trust. They had durable medical powers. So they had everything they needed on an estate plan. The only thing we did is added an IRA stretch provision so that the respective IRAs would go to each spouse. But when the last spouse passed away, the stretch provisions would come into effect and the payments from the IRA would go to their four children and be spread out over their life expectancy at their tax rates rather than a lump sum.
So this wasn't just a plan to get them into retirement, to get them through retirement, actually, because you chose not only the IRA rollover option, but there was an annuity payment option as well that you opted for, as well as a deferral option. So it was a wise strategy that you employed here, as I said, not to just get them into retirement, but to get them through their retirement years. And that is what all retirement planning has to be. It has to be not only just to get you to retirement, but to get you through retirement. Coming up next, Dr. Gary Small, dementia and Alzheimer's, and talk about planning. How do you plan not to have that? We'll find out at financialsense.com.
The good news about medicine today is people are living longer. If you take a look at the life expectancy, our parents weren't expected to live beyond the ages of 63 to 65 for a male. Today, it's in the upper 70s, and for women, it's in the 80s. But one of the problems of aging is losing our faculties. We've heard about diseases, for example, Alzheimer's, which President Reagan had, or dementia. Joining us on the program is Dr. Gary Small. He's the Parlow Solomon Professor on Aging and Professor of Psychiatry at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He's also the author of numerous books, including the Alzheimer's Prevention Program, Keep Your Brain Healthy, and also many other books on the subject. Doctor, one of the things that I found remarkable about your book is it was always thought that something like dementia or Alzheimer's was primarily a hereditary disease, but in your research and studies, you found that to be the opposite.
Yeah, if you look at the MacArthur study, Successful Aging, and they defined successful aging as mental or cognitive success as well as physical success, there's a formula. On average, about two-thirds of what determines our health as we age comes from non-genetic factors. That means for the average person, less than half is from what we inherit from our parents. That means that a lot of everyday lifestyle choices we make have a big impact on how long we can expect to live and how well we can expect to live during those remaining years.
What would you say are some of the most destructive things that we could do along those lifestyle choices? I can imagine, doctor, that stress would be one of them. Poor diet would be one of them. Lack of exercise. Are these the common things that maybe bring on the onset of something like dementia or even Alzheimer's?
Well, it's hard to say that they bring them on, but they certainly are modifiable risk factors. And others include smoking, being overweight or obese in midlife, or not getting proper treatment for illnesses like high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So these are simple measures that many of us can take to extend the probability that we'll live longer free of dementia.
And once you have some of these issues that come up, I guess maybe one of the things I know, for example, today with heart disease, we've made broad strides in combating the disease. We have medications that people take. We can have diet changes. There's even surgery and other measures that we can take to extend life. What are the things that you can do? Let's just say that you lived a stressful life. You were overweight. You decide, now I want to get my act into gear. I want to lose weight. I want to start taking care of myself. Is it too late?
I always say it's never too late to start protecting your brain and start living better longer. Now, certainly the earlier we start, the better the outcome, because it's not just living a brain healthy lifestyle for a week or 2 weeks or a month. It's really trying to develop habits that keep our brains healthy for the long haul. So that is the big challenge, is to try to help people develop these habits. But it is possible through the books that my wife and I have written, through the programs we've developed at UCLA. We have devised ways of making it easy, making it doable for the average person, and they start seeing results right away, which motivates them to continue for years to come.
And doctor, what are some of these healthy habits? I know in my wife's family, both her mother and grandmother were bridge masters and lived well into their later ages. And I can't help but thinking anybody that became a bridge master would really be working the brain as a muscle, because it takes a lot of concentration. Is it things like that besides, you know, when we think of keeping ourselves healthy, of course, we think of diet and exercise, but what about brain health?
Well, certainly mental stimulation is good for the brain. And whether it's playing bridge or playing brain games, any of these types of approaches can be helpful. But, you know, a lot of people try to do some of these things and they don't enjoy them. You've got to find things that work for you, that you enjoy, rather than things that other people tell you to do. So bridge is not for everybody. Learning a language is not for everybody. So I always recommend that people try to train and not strain their brain. So they find mentally stimulating activities that are engaging, are challenging, but not too challenging, so they're difficult and they give up, and not so easy that they're boring and they're not really stimulating.
So, say, for example, doing something different. I don't know, let's say you're an accountant, taking up a foreign language, taking up painting. There's even programs out there, doctor, and I wonder if you might address them, things like Lumosity that are actually brain games that challenge your brain in doing things that you've never done before.
So there are, you know, Lumosity and a program I helped develop, Dacom Brain Fitness, and some of these have been tested in scientific ways. I know that Dacom Brain Fitness has, and a study done by Dr. Karen Miller found that after 2 months of playing the game 5 days a week, there was improvement in memory, and after 6 months, it was even better. Now, I don't know about the studies about Lumosity. I know Posit Science has some positive studies, but we do know that it's possible to teach people, in addition to stimulating their minds, we can teach them memory techniques to compensate for age-related decline. And those are the kinds of techniques that we've developed in our books, techniques like look, snap, connect. So look is a reminder to focus your attention. The biggest reason people forget is they're simply distracted and not paying attention. Snap is a reminder to develop mental snapshots or visual images to help you remember. We know the brain is hardwired to remember visually. It takes advantage of that. And finally, connect is a way of making those visual images or snapshots meaningful. Something is meaningful, it will be memorable.
Doctor, I know that maybe you can address this issue that some of the chemicals they put in things like aluminum in, let's say, deodorants have been found harmful to the brain. Do you subscribe to that in your research? Is that proven to be true?
You know, we know as the brain ages, a lot of different things happen to it. And some of these things are very disturbing. I mean, if you hit your head, it will damage your brain. And we know that we can expose our brains to a toxin that can be damaging. And what we want to do is try to protect our brains as much as possible, limit different kinds of exposures such as that. So, you know, I always tell people it's a good idea to be careful. You know, there are even sick buildings where people can, maybe not so much their brains, but they can develop allergies and develop other kinds of problems. So it's really important to keep in mind that our brains are delicate.
Let's talk about your book, because there's things that you can talk about developing healthy habits that can prevent the onset of the disease, if it's hereditary, or maybe even possibly reverse it. What are those things that we can do? We talked about the obvious, you know, healthy lifestyle, healthy foods, keeping toxins out of the body, exercise, and maybe challenging the brain. What are some common things that the individual can do that would not be very difficult? I have found a lot of times with individuals, if it's easy and can be habit forming, it's more likely to be successful.
Yeah. So what we do, we get people on a program and we might recommend daily exercise. So somebody can get into the habit of taking a walk after breakfast or after dinner. Another thing you can do is walk with a friend or your spouse. Then you can have a conversation, and the conversation can be brain stimulating as well. So you're getting your heart to pump oxygen and nutrients to your brain cells. You're getting your body to produce a chemical called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is from the exercise. And BDNF is like fertilizer for your brain cells. It gets them to sprout branches and communicate more effectively. The conversation will stimulate your brain cells. And if you talk about something that is important to you and disturbing to you, and it's an empathic ear, that can lower your stress level. And we know that stress is not good for the brain. It can actually shrink the memory centers of the brain. So just taking a walk with a friend every day is, in a way, a triple threat against Alzheimer's disease.
Something that simple.
When you get home, what you want to do is eat a healthy lunch and a healthy dinner. And what I recommend in terms of diet are several suggestions. First, to try to curtail the number of calories we ingest each day. We have a worldwide epidemic of overweight and obesity, and these illnesses can increase your risk for diabetes, for high blood pressure, and in and of themselves, they can increase the risk for Alzheimer's. People who are overweight have a twofold increased risk for Alzheimer's. If they're obese, it's a fourfold increase. So eating smaller meals throughout the day and having mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks helps people to not feel too hungry and not binge and go off their diet. Every meal should have a combination of healthy protein and healthy carbohydrates. The proteins help maintain lean muscle mass. The carbohydrates and also the proteins help sustain your sense of satiety so you don't get hungry too quickly. Carbohydrates give you energy, and the healthy carbohydrates are fresh fruits and vegetables. Try to avoid those processed foods and refined sugars, which tend to increase risk for diabetes. So there is a kind of brain-healthy diet that is very important.
Is there anything that somebody should do? Let's say that from a family history, Alzheimer's runs in the family. Should those that have hereditary risk, or at least at high risk for maybe contracting the disease, are there things that they should do more so than somebody else?
I think that the Alzheimer's Prevention Program, the last book we wrote, it's really for everyone, whether you have a genetic risk or not. And there's science behind that. For example, in our research group and scientists at Washington University in St. Louis have found that people who, for example, exercise more, they have less amyloid in their brain than those who do not exercise. And these are people who already have the genetic risk for Alzheimer's. So having a genetic risk is not a reason to give up. Now, certainly if there's a family history and a known genetic risk, those people tend to be more motivated. We don't recommend people get genetic testing except in special circumstances where they have a very high rate of Alzheimer's in their family, where 50% of relatives get the disease. And in that case, we refer them to genetic counselors so they can decide whether to get those tests.
Now, you've written several books on this subject. You've been studying it for a long period of time. Are there things that you have discovered recently over the last couple of years that you have found this is a breakthrough or this is really significant in either reversing the disease, preventing it, or extending life?
As I've studied it and other groups have studied it, I am just more compelled by the science that we all have more control than we think. I was in Copenhagen this past summer at the World Alzheimer's Convention, and there were several very compelling studies showing that if you help people modify their risk factors for the disease, it has an impact. And so the programs that we've developed where we have a combination approach, where we try to tailor it, where people come in and we realize, boy, you've got to go on a diet. That's really where you have to emphasize your work. Or you've got to get more mental stimulation. Or you've got to exercise more. Whatever it may be, we still combine it across all the different domains of lifestyle. Staying socially connected, reducing stress, keeping yourself mentally stimulated, maintaining a level of physical exercise, making sure you don't smoke, and so forth. So I think a combination approach is really important.
And all of these factors combined, I mean, we're learning more and more about what we can do. Now, one of the significant things that have happened with heart disease, we've had surgery, we've got drugs. Are there drugs in the stage of development now that can prevent or seriously reverse the disease or maybe put it into remission?
Right now, there isn't anything like that. We do have drugs that help people stay at a higher level of functioning longer. These are the medicines that have been around for a number of years that we prescribe for patients with Alzheimer's, medicines like donepezil or Aricept, rivastigmine or Exelon or memantine or Namenda. And these drugs sometimes can give you some temporary improvement, but keep people on a higher level of functioning longer, and they help a lot of individuals. Unfortunately, we can't stop the progression of the disease. There are many studies that are ongoing that are trying to do that, but we don't have a magic cure as yet.
And let's talk about a situation where, let's say, an individual has been recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia. We have the onset of the disease. What can be done effectively that can keep it in remission, if that is possible, prolong it, or bring a quality of life, or extend that quality of life? What can be done?
You know, the first thing is to go to the doctor sooner rather than later. We find that the earlier we can help people, the better the outcome. It's much easier to protect a healthy brain than try to repair damage once it's present. So when people come to our programs and many other doctors out there, we deal with the medical issues. We find out if there's any medical condition that could be contributing to the problem, drug toxicity, thyroid imbalance, and so forth. If it's indicated, we put them on the medicines that help with the symptoms, the ones I mentioned earlier. And then we also alter their lifestyle so that they're exercising and eating right and having an appropriate level of stimulation so that they can enjoy their lives as much as possible for as long as possible.
So outside of doing some of these things, is there anything else that you have found to be especially helpful? I guess the issue of understanding from others, whether it's a spouse, children, because one of the things that we come across sometimes where somebody is dealing with their finances and they're making decisions that they're not cognizant of making. They forget that they do something. What are some of the things that should be done there? I would suspect that having durable medical powers or things where you can act on the other's behalf, are there other things like that?
I think that it's critically important for family members to really look at all the issues, become educated, to understand what's going on, because that has a big impact on the patient, and the disease has a big impact on the family. And yes, looking at durable power of attorney, looking at advanced directives, having the conversation sooner rather than later, allow the patient to be involved in these discussions so that their wishes are carried out. And caregiving is a tough one. 50% or more of primary caregivers of dementia patients become depressed. So we've got to make sure that the caregivers are taking care of their own needs and not getting burned out, because, you know, depression can be infectious in a way. You know, you're around someone who's down, that's going to affect their own mood. And it works the other way, too. Dementia patients or Alzheimer patients develop depression as well, and that can affect the caregiver. So I think it's really a family disease that we have to pay attention to.
And, Doctor, what about a situation where somebody does have Alzheimer's or dementia? A number of years ago, I was in a situation with a client where the client basically got loose, got in his car, took off, and they found him the next day in a parking lot in another city.
Well, this is very disturbing. You know, the Alzheimer's Association has a program where families can get a bracelet so that if they wander off, they can be found. But this brings up a lot of issues about monitoring patients, being aware of where they are, what they're doing. But there's no easy answer, because we also want to protect the autonomy of patients. We don't want to infantilize them. We want to maintain their independence for as long as possible. So we hear about these very frightening cases. All we can do is try to be vigilant of the safety issues and try to help families protect patients, themselves, and the rest of the public.
So, Doctor, as we close, you've written a number of books. The one that comes to mind is the one that you have on the Alzheimer's Prevention Program. You have several others, the Memory Prescription, and the other one, the iBrain Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. If somebody has Alzheimer's running in the family, has a spouse, or maybe it's a child that has a parent, if you were to recommend the book that you think would be the most helpful, because you've written a number of them, which one would it be?
Well, I think from my portfolio of books, I would recommend the Alzheimer's Prevention Program, because anybody who has a disease in their family is going to be concerned about it. They're going to want to know the facts about their genetic risk. They want to know the science behind what they should do, and the book provides that. And it also translates the latest science into practical strategies and offers a one-week program that you can follow to get started, to give you a sense of what it's like to live a brain-healthy lifestyle. And that's just the beginning of protecting your brain for the rest of your life.
Well, Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on our program. And once again, folks, the name of the book that Doctor was talking about, it's called The Alzheimer's Prevention Program. Keep your brain healthy for the rest of your life. And that's by Gary Small. Doctor, thanks for joining us on the program. Keep up the great work. And hopefully someday we're going to see a breakthrough.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You know, one of the interesting things about that interview with Dr. Gary Small is the advances that we're making in medicine. And we're finding out over the years, whether it's dealing with cancer, with heart disease, we're making great strides in combating these diseases. But so much of what we're dealing with today are lifestyle choices, whether it's our diets, our exercise, the stress we put ourselves under. The great news about this, so much of this is preventable, sometimes reversible. And one of the things that I was really surprised when I read his book, because I always thought Alzheimer's dementia was something like it was primarily hereditary. But as the doctor talked about in that interview, 75% of it is lifestyle choices. Now think about that, 75%. There's so many things that you can do to keep yourself healthy. You've worked hard all your life to accumulate this money that you want to take into retirement. What a shame would it be to get to retirement and not have the health to enjoy it. So I hope if you have it running in your family, or you've seen a relative or a friend go through this debilitating disease, pick up the book. So much of this can be avoided by simply altering and taking a few steps to change your lifestyle. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, well, we've run out of time here, but we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.